Okay, we're on the line to Mr. Robert Sheldon, who was our outstanding bandmaster in 1990, and we're going to do an interview for our international website of Phi Beta Mu. Mr. Sheldon, how are you today?
I am doing great. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Well, we're excited to hear and get inside your mind about your career and your life. I'm sure many will be very interested in what makes you tick. So let's begin with, how did you get started in band in your early years, maybe some of your directors and the influential people in your life?
Well, I grew up in Florida, in Bradenton, actually, and a lot of my friends were involved in band. So band back in those days started in seventh grade. So I had already been playing violin and orchestra starting in sixth, and then in seventh began band with two wonderful directors, Robert Greatwood, who I studied with for many years because he later became high school director, and Charles Cornby, who was the high school director at the time and the assistant to start beginners back there in seventh grade. So there were two really wonderful people to start with there.
And
I started
on
that would have been, oh, goodness.
Approximately.
Oh, just shortly after the earth cooled, I believe, Keith. I'm trying to remember. Well, I graduated from high school in 72, and this would have been 6 years prior to that.
Okay.
So, you know,
just a whippersnapper
somewhere in there, yeah. And so anyway, yeah, that's when I would have started that. I started on trombone and played, you know, all the way through school. I also played a lot of other instruments during those days as well. And they were my directors were very supportive of that. So I played a lot of woodwinds through school. I played most of the brass instruments, but they were very very supportive and very helpful. Really enjoyed my time in school in Bradenton, Manatee High School. Started Walker Junior High and went on to Manatee.
Wow. And then what interested you in college and where did you decide to go?
Well, I decided to go to the University of Miami. I had already started writing a lot of music when I was in high school, and two of the people who I was most interested in studying with were in composition were actually teaching at the University of Miami, which would have been Clifton Williams and Alfred Reed. So I decided to go to Miami to study, and I wasn't sure at the time. I was thinking I was going to be a jazz major. I had worked with Jerry Coker previously, and he was a wonderful teacher, and I thought I might be a jazz major, and so that was another reason to go to Miami. And I also had fallen in love, of course, with all those old Eastman Mercury recordings that Dr. Fennell had done, and Fred Fennell was at the University of Miami at that time. So it was just a reason I thought this is where I wanted to go. So I wasn't sure of my major at the time, maybe composition or jazz. As it turned out, I went into music education, but still did a lot of jazz work at Miami and did composition with Clifton Williams and arranging with Alfred Reed and also with John Kenyon. And then, of course, Dr. Fennell was my conducting teacher and my band director there.
Wow. That's quite a lineup.
Yeah, it was sort of amazing that they were all there at that time, but it was a great experience, and I really learned a lot. One of the reasons I went to Miami was I knew that I could work my way through school because there was a lot of work at that time out on Miami Beach playing in different clubs and shows, and so that was also another primary reason I wanted to go to school there. But I was an oboe major at the time and then playing, you know, woodwinds basically in shows and whatever out on the beach. So got through school, and then 4 years later went back to University of Florida to study with Frank Wicks to get a conducting degree there, and also work with Richard Bowles on composition, which was also a tremendous experience. So I was very fortunate.
Now, was Ted Krager at Miami?
Yes, he was. Yeah,
he
was.
He came
from
West
Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, Connie Weldon was the dean at the time. We had some wonderful people there, Lee Chelson and choir. And it was just a tremendous faculty. And they were all really good people to work with and very approachable. And they made campus life there really quite a very special event.
So you were torn between teaching, performing, and composing. So how did you begin your first job, or how did you choose that?
Well, I had been, you know, it's one of these things. I had been playing professionally for so long that by the time I graduated from college, I pretty much decided I was sort of done with that, you know, which is strange. I know it seems like that's something you would just do forever, but I was really more interested in writing and teaching. So when I finished, I continued to play during my first year out of college, but I remember on New Year's Eve, I was playing a gig in Miami, and I thought, why am I doing this?
Uh-huh.
You know, I was recently married. I hear I'm 45 miles from my wife. It's New Year's Eve. I really don't want to do this anymore. And that was the last, I didn't pay my union dues after that and just sort of stopped playing. So that was the end of my performing career, which actually I never really missed. But I did so much of it early on. I think I got my fill of it. And then my first teaching job was in West Palm Beach, and took an inner-city school, and it was a very challenging position, and I learned so much there. But, you know, when you love to teach, it takes all of your first energies. And so even though I wanted to be able to write and do other things, I found I really wasn't doing much of it because everything was going into teaching. You know, every student you see, how can you reach them? How can you make this a better experience? And like I say, it was a very challenging experience. So I really had to work hard at that. And I was there for 4 years before finally going back and getting my master's at the University of Florida.
And were you alone there in that job? Did you have an assistant?
Oh, no, I was alone. As a matter of fact, I have never had an assistant anywhere I've taught. So with my first job there, it was a band and orchestra position, and it was a small program, but we got it to grow a bit, and it was, but no, there was no assistant there. And then my second job was at the laboratory school at the University of Florida, and there was certainly no assistant there. It was really just a before school and a couple other class period type of job. And then my third position was at Southeast High School in Bradenton, and even though I had 330 students, I did not have an assistant. It was still just, you know, that's just the way that worked. Again, band and orchestra position. And then I moved up to, and then I taught at Florida State University, and I guess I was the assistant there. So it was an assistant professor of music and assistant band director to James Croft. So that was the job there. And then when I moved to Illinois, I took over another band and orchestra position, but here again, no assistant. So I've never had an assistant to work with.
Wow. And it's interesting you've named a couple of our outstanding bandmasters, James Croft and Frank Wicks. And that's really unique that you three guys are in there. So,
well, you know, they were also very important to me growing up too, because when I was a young band director, Jim actually was teaching for a time at the University of South Florida, and Mallory Thompson, I had met her back in those days too. So they were, you know, these are people that were also very helpful to me. And I had met Frank before I started studying there at University of Florida. He was also just somebody who was very helpful. And these were all people who were just heroes to me because they'd had such amazing programs and they were such tremendous musicians. And it turned out they were also really good people and good friends and great teachers.
So let's talk about your university career and where you've been and what you're doing now.
Well, I was teaching at the time in Bradenton High School there. It was kind of funny, you know, in Florida, and Florida's not unique in this way, but in Florida, the football was a big deal. And two of the big teams in Florida always, of course, are the, you know, the Florida State Seminoles and the University of Florida Gators. And the band that I was working with, the high school band that I was with, we were the Southeast Seminoles. So we had the same logo as Florida State University, but our school colors were orange and blue like the University of Florida.
Uh-huh.
It was kind of an unusual mix. But I was teaching there at the time and asked if I would apply for the job at Florida State, which was Bentley Schellhammer had been in that position for several years and was moving up to dean at FSU, and he was going to leave that position open. And so I thought, well, I would just see what it was like. I'd never really known a whole lot about Florida State, but I thought it would be interesting to go up and meet the people there and see what the job was all about. Of course, it was a wonderful school. It was a fantastic place to be. Cliff Mattson was my division head, and he was a great person to get to know and kind of a wonderful protector for a young, you know, first-time collegiate band director. And, of course, Jim Croft was there, and we had a wonderful time. It was tremendous. So taught there for a couple of years. I met my second wife there at the time and decided, really, at this point in my career, I was starting to miss writing. It was difficult to write. I was continuing to write through this entire time. And as I'd say 8-9 years prior to moving to Florida State, I started doing a lot of guest conducting for honor bands, that kind of thing, and I was doing a lot of writing. And when I got to Florida State, that the job was so time-consuming, because one of my jobs there was, of course, I was in charge of the marching chiefs. So if you have a 450-piece marching band you're working with, and, of course, the team's good, which means you're constantly doing bowl games and every week's a televised game, it's a lot of time. And I enjoyed it, and I'm so glad I did it, but it was also nearly impossible for me to have the kind of time I needed to really enjoy writing. And after doing that for a couple of years, I felt, you know, I feel like I'm missing something here, and I really wanted to be able to find a way to get back into doing some writing. And at that point in time, I had just married my second wife. She was getting ready to graduate from Florida State with her doctorate in music ed, and we just made the decision that wherever she found a job, we would go, she would teach, I would write, and we wanted to start a family. So that's actually what happened. She took a job at Illinois State University, instrumental music ed. I left Florida State and took another high school band and orchestra position, and we had a daughter, so things they went right on schedule, just the way we wanted them to be. And I really enjoyed my next job, the band and orchestra position at East Peoria. It was just a great place to be, and it allowed me a lot of time to do the kind of writing I wanted to do. And that's when the writing part of my career really, I think, took off, because I had more time to do it. I was accepting more commissions, started doing a lot more guest conducting, and then it just became a very busy but happy time.
Well, that's interesting. Yes, I know all of us have played your wonderful pieces for, well, all grade levels.
Aren't you nice? Thank you.
they're so well written, and kids love to play them, and I judge a lot, and I hear them all over, all the time. So I was curious as how that road led to away from conducting and directing to that, and you get to do both. So that's wonderful.
It really is. It's been a nice mix. Over the past few years, things have really changed quite a bit, because after I taught for I think probably a total of 28 years, one of my publishers at Alfred Music had asked if I would come on board as a concert band editor for them. This would have been back in 2003. So I've been with them for 13 years now. And that was really a leap to say, you know, I'm going to end my teaching career and go into private enterprise, you know, and work for a company. But at the same time, I thought, you know, here I'm like 50 years old, and how often do you have an opportunity to do something like that that's very much related to what you've all done your entire life, but it's still a different type of thing? I thought it'd be challenging and interesting, and it was, and I've really enjoyed it. And one of the reasons I think they wanted me to come on board with them is that they wanted me to do as much writing and conducting as I could. And by them supporting that, it's allowed me to have a lot more freedom to write and conduct things that I may not have had a chance to do otherwise. Over the past few years, it's led to a lot of international type of things, which I never really would have thought of. But I've been thoroughly enjoying traveling, you know, a lot of different places, conducting groups in, you know, different countries and different places that I never really thought I might. And at the same time, they want me to come and conduct music that I've written. So it's very special.
Yes, they want to meet the composer, and that's, well, your career has been a musical buffet in a sorts. So,
you know, it kind of has. Somebody, I forget who it was I was talking to, but they were asking, it was something similar to the sort of an interview where they were asking about how did you get from point A to point B, And it, you know, and after discussing things such as, you know, the some of the people I'd worked with, and you know, I'd mentioned, you know, growing up in Florida, that's when Disney World opened, and so I got to play as a high school member. I got to play in the opening ceremonies of Disney World with Meredith Wilson being our band director, and you know, and doing all the. And I was just talking about these various things, and whoever it was said, you know, this reminds me, it's like you're the Forrest Gump of bands.
Right.
And I thought, well, in a way, you know, that's probably pretty close. But I've been fortunate because I've been in a lot of the right places at the right time, at least for me. And I've enjoyed everything I've done everywhere I've been. You know, not every job has been ideal. Not everything you conduct is going to be, you know, what you want it to be. And not every piece you write is what you hope it would be. But it's fun to really try to make it work. And that's to me is what I've always found interesting about teaching is what do you have to do to make it work? Okay, that didn't work. Let's try something else. And same kind of thing, writing and conducting.
Well, you've had such a wide range of experience. Does anything stick out or jump out as a personal highlight in your career?
You know, that is a very difficult thing to assess because it has been so varied. I mean, you know, I think back to, like, for instance, being with the Marching Chiefs, and I'm not really a marching band guy, but that group was so amazing. You know, there were so many of them. It was such an enormous group, and they sounded so beautiful. They played really, really well. And, you know, standing with them and listening to them play and watching them perform was, that you know, with 100,000 people on their feet screaming, you know, that's really kind of it's a very special type of thing. Or premiering, I've premiered pieces in the Sydney Opera House and then the Carnegie Hall, and, you know, being in these wonderful, you know, venues, Orchestra Hall in Chicago or Symphony Hall in Boston or the Kennedy Center or, you know, just some wonderful places around the world, you know, the Fujisawa Hall in Japan or the National Opera House in Taipei, and you're premiering a piece that you've written, and that's a very overwhelming feeling to me, thinking, wow, you know, how did I even get here? How did this happen? You know, and to be able to you know, bring a piece of music to life for the first time in these places and just see how that goes. You know, I just had a kind of an interesting experience a couple months ago in the Florida Bandmasters Association. I have a great affinity for all my friends in Florida. That, you know, they taught me so much as a young band director, and so many of those directors have remained really, really good friends over the years. And unfortunately, as we've all gotten a little older, we've lost some dear friends. Several of my, you know, mentors from Florida have passed on, and the Florida Bandmasters Association now has twice commissioned me to write a piece in honor of, you know, one of the legendary directors in Florida. And recently, they had asked me to do a piece for Jack Crew, and I was so honored to do that. And I had no idea what to write for him. But I was speaking with Alex Kaminsky, who his band was playing in Midwest and who was involved with this commissioning project, and said, you know, Jack loved Richard Strauss. You need to write a piece kind of in the style of Richard Strauss, like with Longford Legend being in the style of Granger and Holst and Vaughan Williams, an original piece that would sort of, you know, bring to mind the sounds of Richard Strauss. And I thought that was quite an assignment, and I wasn't really sure how that would work, but I did do the piece, and unfortunately I couldn't premiere it at Allstate in Florida because I was premiering another piece at the Nebraska Allstate the very same day. But here 2 months ago I was conducting in Germany, and the group that I was conducting said, we see you've written a German piece.
Oh.
And I said, I'm not a German piece. And they said, yes, Der Lehrmeister. And I said, well, the title's German, but it's not really a German piece. But it's based on, you know, the style of Richard. Oh, we must play Der Lehrmeister when you come. So I had a chance to, in front of a German audience, to do a European premiere in Germany of Der Lehrmeister. And I was a little tense about it because I thought, are they going to think I'm, you know, how are they going to accept this piece? I wasn't quite sure. But the reaction was really overwhelming, and it was such a special experience because the group played it so incredibly well, and to be able to do that there. And it was, you know, there have been some experiences like this. It's hard to quantify because I can't say that one is better than another. It's just that they're all different, and it sort of creates a huge tapestry for your life that you know it's a wonderful thing to be able to look at these elements, and I just feel so fortunate that I've had these experiences.
They may have thought of that as Strauss with augmentation or on steroids.
Kind of, yeah. But you know, it was the thing that was bizarre about that piece is they wanted the piece in Florida to be accessible to younger bands. Mm-hmm. And I told them at the time, I said, you want a piece that's like Richard Strauss, but you want it as a grade 3.5? Strauss did not write grade 3.5 music. So that's where the challenge came in. But you know, I was very pleased with it when I got to do it, and it's being published this year, so it's going to come out next year, and I'm very happy about that, especially for Jack, because Jack's family was there for the premiere performance, and they're just very special people.
So out, and I want to ask you which is your favorite composition of your works, but are there any other outside of your works compositions that are your favorites through the years?
You know, there are, and probably too many to mention. What comes to mind immediately, and I don't know how people decide what their favorite pieces are, but when I was at the University of Miami, although I was not a particularly great oboist, I did get to play with Snell in his wind ensemble and also English Horn and Orchestra, but I never considered myself to be a great oboist. I was just hanging on. But my oboe teacher, what he did for me, which was so special, was he would give me tickets to go hear the Miami Philharmonic in Guzman Hall. And he really just wanted me to hear him play. I know that was what that was all about. But one evening, sitting there in Guzman Hall, they did an encore. And the encore was the second suite to the Ravel Daphnis and Chloe. And I had never heard it. I didn't know what the piece was. It wasn't in the program. And here I am sitting there listening to this, and I was so drawn in. I was so mesmerized. And Daphnis and Chloe, the entire ballet, has always remained one of my favorites. I also, in addition to Jack Crew, I also love the music of Richard Strauss, especially, you know, Don Juan. It's such a, to me, is a piece I can listen to and never really tire of. I love the music of Respighi. I think probably what the connection is between the pieces that I love is the vastness and the colorful variety of the orchestration. Mm-hmm. And those are the reasons I tend to listen to the pieces that have such incredible colors that the composers have been able to bring to life through their orchestration. So I tend to, even nowadays when I, you know, go up to hear the Chicago Symphony, I only live a couple hours away from Orchestra Hall. But if I'm going to go hear a concert, yes, I love Mozart. Yes, I love Beethoven. But it's going to be the concert that when they're doing the Planets, that's when I'll go. Because
right.
I want to hear the vast resources that the orchestra can offer. So I tend towards those types of pieces.
That's interesting. And it does, it is reflected in your work, and which brings us to, out of all your pieces, which was your favorite? Now, not just the one that sold the most, but which was your favorite composition?
Please don't think that I'm avoiding your answer here, but the answer to this question is, it's the piece I'm working on next.
That's a great answer.
Because, it's absolutely true, because everything you do, at least for me, everything that I have ever written or performed or heard influences, and everything you've ever experienced in your life personally influences the next note you're going to write. And so even though I may love the last piece that I just wrote, whatever it is, or maybe I didn't, but whatever it is I've experienced since then personally, I'm excited to be able to put into the next piece. So as soon as I start the next piece, it's like it's an all-encompassing, you know, total energy goes into it because I can't wait to see where it's going to go. And so my favorite piece is always the one that I'm working on right now.
So you've never wrapped up one and said, that's it?
No, but there have been a few pieces, very few, that when I put the final bar line on them, I felt like, you know what, that's pretty good. You know, and I think my tastes have changed over time. But I can remember way back, my first piece I wrote on a commission that was being premiered at Midwest Convention with Southwest Saga back in 1985. And I can remember putting the final bar line on that piece, and it was the first piece I had ever written that wrote itself from the first note right to the left. I didn't have to go back and fix things or change things or start in the middle and put a new introduction. It went straight through from beginning to end, and I thought, you know what? I really like this. And I felt that way. That would have been a Southwest Saga.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And I can remember, I felt very much the same way when I finished A Longford Legend. That, I felt really good about how that was. But you know, there's other pieces, too, along the way that I felt very good about. Some have done, commercially have done really well. Some really have not, but it hasn't diminished my appreciation for them at the time. And sometimes I'm just amazed that, well, why didn't that piece sell very well? I thought that was a pretty good piece. And then, of course, there's other pieces you write and you go, I'm not sure I'm too thrilled about it. And that, of course, is the one that sells a gazillion copies. So there's no telling. But I just love I love to be able to write, and for me, the thing that's so special about it is I love to be able to go and conduct groups, whether or not they're playing my music or not, and if they are playing something of mine, the thing I've found that is a little weird is I tend to give my own pieces the least amount of attention when I'm in rehearsal, because I always feel such an obligation to all the other composers. Like, I want to make sure their music's just right, and, okay, we got 5 minutes. Let's work on this one. We can work on mine. And but I try to be able to, when I'm writing a piece for a group, try to be able to write something that they will feel a part of, and that's also just a really, to me, it's all about communication, and I'm very happy to be able to do that.
Well, your music communicates well at all levels, and that's the neat thing about it. Well, you've mentioned some of the old masters during your early days of teaching. Down to question 11, what helped you most in those early years or throughout your career, or anything you'd like to tell young directors just beginning their career?
I think that what really helped for me was I never looked at what I was doing as a job. It was just something I was doing because I loved to do it. As a matter of fact, when I got my first teaching job and I got my first paycheck, I just stared at it like, they're paying me to do this. I can remember physically looking at it and going, I can't believe I actually get paid to do this. It was something that I just loved to do. I also think, and I don't know where this came from, but I always felt a sense of confidence that I was going to be able to make a positive difference. So I never gave up. It was always always a matter of persevering. And, well, this didn't work, so I'm going to try something else. And I don't know what's going to work, so I need to talk to some other people and find out what they do. But I never felt like, this is hopeless, this is awful, I'm not enjoying this. I always just, no matter what it was, and there were some tough times in those early days, there were some tough times, but I never felt defeated. I always felt challenged and always found a way to have a lot of fun and to enjoy the kids. I just enjoyed working with them and seeing their progress and seeing their personalities and helping them put part of their personality into their music as well. So for me, it's always just been a joyful experience. And I think for a young teacher, I would just say, don't give up. It's not going to happen overnight. You need to ask a lot of friends, a lot of people that maybe are not friends yet. You need to make friends with people and figure out what it is they do to be successful. I have always, when I've had the opportunity when I was younger and I would go to the state conventions and I would always go to the rehearsals for the Allstate band. And I would sit in, I would get there before the first rehearsal started and watch, how does this person start rehearsal? What do they do? I want to watch them for hours. I want to see what are they saying? How are they, what are the gestures they're using? What are their facial expressions? How are they approaching it? How are they pacing the rehearsal? What music did they select? Why did they select it? And I was always amazed that I would be in there watching, and there wasn't anybody else there. And, you know, you could tell there were a lot of band directors sitting out in the hallway talking about, you know, what are you doing for marching band next year or whatever. But it always surprised me there weren't as many people inside watching rehearsal. And to be honest with you, this was actually, I hadn't thought about it till now, but my very first semester at University of Miami, I was not good enough on oboe to play in anything back then. But I was an oboe major. And I was taking lessons on several other instruments. So I had just come from an alto sax lesson. And I knew that the very first wind ensemble rehearsal of the year was going to be coming up right then. So I ran directly from my sax lesson, had my sax with me in my sax case, into Nancy Green Hall, University of Miami, so I could watch Fred Fennell conduct this rehearsal. And I sat over on the side, and I got there because I thought this room will probably be really crowded, lots of people watching, right? I was the only one there.
Amazing.
So I'm sitting on the side of the room watching the very first wind ensemble rehearsal of the semester, and in walks Dr. Fennell, and, you know, he climbs up on those three podiums. He was kind of short, and he's towering over everybody now on these big three blocks, and he's looking around, and there's an empty seat. And he stares at it and points over to the seat and says, "Where is he?" And the first alto sax player looks at the empty chair next to them and says, "Dr. Fennell, I don't think he's coming back to school this semester." And there was this dead silence, and Fennell scans the room, and he looks over, and he sees this guy sitting on the side of the room with an alto sax case, and he didn't say anything. He just pointed at me and pointed to the empty chair. I got my sax out, and I played second alto sax in wind ensemble my first semester. And I know I must have made at least 50 sax players really mad by doing that, but, I mean, I wasn't going to tell them no. And I, you know, and this was sort of an example of I wouldn't have missed that rehearsal. I just wanted to see what he was going to do. As it turned out, I wound up playing in wind ensemble that semester and then finally made it in on oboe my second semester. But, yeah, I mean, I just think it's great to be able to watch rehearsals. And that's one of the things I miss now, because generally when I'm at an all-state or I'm at a regional thing, I'm conducting. And they always schedule rehearsals for the chorus and the orchestra basically at the same time. So you can't really, even when you take a break, they're on break too.
Right.
But whenever I have an opportunity, I love going in and watching people conduct. And, you know, even people who aren't so good at it are also interesting to watch too. You can learn a lot from them as well, maybe things not to do. But, you know, they even have redeeming qualities that are, you know, you can watch somebody who just really doesn't do these things very well but might be really good at something else, and you can learn from them as well. So I would tell young directors, seek out rehearsals from quality conductors and just go watch. Go to a great high school or a junior high school, a really good middle school. Watch how they do rehearsals. You know, go watch honor bands and orchestras. Go to choir rehearsals where there's real good choral directors. You learn so much about breathing and phrasing. And, you know, go to great orchestras and watch rehearsals. You learn so much about bowing, and it all relates to phrasing and breathing. And you know, there's just so many things. So never stop learning. And that's another reason why this is such a great career to be in.
Right. That's an excellent closing remark. And that is where the learning takes place. I mean, how else will you learn if you don't watch someone that's doing your craft?
That's exactly right. And then you just can't wait to apply it yourself. And that's why this is such a, you know, we are all so fortunate that we did this. And I got to tell you, I just feel so sorry for kids nowadays who don't go into music. I just feel sorry for them, because I see the kids that I get to work with in these honor bands and different places that I'm working in, how happy they are and well-adjusted and excited and interesting and interested. And then you see other kids that, you know, they have other things going on in their lives, but when they finish high school, you take a look at those kids, and so often all they do is go up to their rooms and play video games.
Right.
And the kids that were involved in music, they're still involved in stuff. They have things to do. They're having a good time. They interact with each other. And I think especially today when kids don't interact in the same ways anymore. They interact electronically a lot more than they do in person. And that's why I think live musical ensemble performances are so important it, for all, you know, the artistic reasons, of course, but also socially, I just think it's such a, an important thing. And I really hope that, that you know, as time goes on, that capital E education will really understand the true value of what music can do, not only with regard to supporting the arts, but also what it can do for the whole student and making them better people and better students and better academically and just creating better citizens. So hopefully that'll be something that'll happen here in our lifetime.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your insight and giving us some time today, and we will get this posted on our Phi Beta Mu International website. And thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you. And, you know, this was such a great honor and such a surprise back in 1990 when that happened. And I still look back on it, and I'm kind of flabbergasted. So the other members of this, you know, who have received this award are far more worthy of it than I, but I'm so honored to be a part of the whole project. And I thank you for calling this morning.
Well, thank you, and bye-bye.